Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borak Thungathletes, welcome to the 2000 AD Thrillcast. I am your host, Molchar.
And I am PR droid, Owen.
And we stand upon the brink of another episode of Stop punching the air. It's not as if that was our first take or anything. We're going to be talking to Dan Abnett and Ian Coulbard about the new series of Brink, which begins in this week's 2000 AD. A perfect issue for anybody who's curious about reading 2000 AD, doesn't know where to start. Every twice a year, we have a jumping on point. So this is another of our perfect jumping on points. So if you've never read 2000 AD or you're a lapsed reader, jump on board. We've got five stories. We've got a brand new Judge Dredd story by Dredd co-creators John Wagner and Carlos Esquerra. We've got a new series of Brink. We've got a Future Shock by the winners of last year's Thought Bubble Portfolio Competition, which it's great to see them working together on that. And we've got a new series of Scarlet Traces and a new series of Cursed, The Fall of Deadworld. It's a hell of a lineup. But if you've not read 2000 AD for a while, or this is your first time, go back to the last episode, have a listen to some of our recommendations for collections, ways into the galaxy's greatest comic, to give you an idea of what you can expect from 2000 AD. 32 pages, weekly anthology comic book. It's been going for 40 years. You're talking about the best lineup of creators anywhere, really, aren't you?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Who's had a start in our pages? Alan Moore, Mark Miller, Grant Morrison, Garth Ennis. You know, and then you've got the giants like John Wagner and Alan Grant and Carlos Esquerra.
And after the anniversary just passed, this is basically a perfect time to get on board with brand new stories.
Absolutely.
Really good jumping on point for anybody.
The buzz has never really been higher. So, if you've been curious about any of the stuff you've seen, start with 2000 AD. I mean, that's how I start. You know, I just jumped straight in with both feet and haven't really looked back. So, this is a great issue. You can catch up with Scarlet Traces. Because volume one of the complete Scarlet Traces came out earlier this year. Volume two is coming out later this year. Also the collection of Tainted, which is the Fall of Deadworld stories and Dreams of Deadworld, is coming out later this year.
That cover is creepy.
What, it's Tainted?
Yeah.
It's freaky, isn't it? We're going to be debuting that in a couple of weeks' time, hopefully. So, yes, it's an ideal issue. And one of the stories which I've been really looking forward to seeing more of has been Brink. It's Dan Abnett, who, if you've ever read Warhammer or Guardians of the Galaxy, then you know Dan's work. And Ian Coulbard, who has worked with Dan on the new Deadwardians and is the artist on Brass Sun and various other things. This is their humanity cooped up in a tin can with, escaping a now dead Earth. And as we'll discuss, there's been this big boom in kind of, not gritty sci-fi, but realistic sci-fi.
Concept-grounded sci-fi.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's your take on Brink? I mean,
don't brink or you'll miss it. Sorry. That didn't even work. I'm not sure quite why. That just literally doesn't make sense.
I treated it with the contempt it deserves.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It reminds you of all of the classic political and social sci-fi of the 70s. It looks incredibly intense. It's really, really colourful, and especially this new series, as we'll get into, is kind of completely different as well in the way it's laid out with the same space of pages. So it's really one of those real cognitive stay with it stories that is a really great one outside of the normal things I think that 2000 AD does as well to jump in to experience entirely fresh as a story.
It's meaty as well.
Yeah.
You know, this, I mean, it's something that Dan does very well, and all of our writers have to cope with, is doing stuff in 5-page chunks. Mm. So the amount of information per episode is really great. It's something to get sink your teeth into.
It's economically done as well. Mm. It looks effortless, the way they've done it.
And like you say, I really enjoyed Ian stepping up his game with this. I mean, the first series looked beautiful, but this series especially, you know, that the opening of the first episode, just absolutely spot on. It is wonderful to welcome Dan and Ian to the podcast. I think you've been on before, haven't you, Ian?
Maybe. I can't remember. God, it's awful. I should remember something like that, shouldn't I?
It was such a momentous event in your life that...
Yeah, it was. I can't remember. Yeah, maybe.
Anyway, welcome to you both. We're here to talk about Brink, because the new series starts in this week's Prog. And it's just something I'd like to sort of try and get our teeth into a little bit, to discover a bit about your guys' thinking behind the series. Because the one thing that I've noticed is there has been a recent explosion in very good space-based sci-fi. So things like the OA and The Expanse on Netflix and things like that. It seems like proper old school space-based sci-fi is back in vogue. Is this something that you noticed and spurred you on to create Brink, or was it just a happy coincidence?
To be honest, I think it was a happy coincidence. Obviously, Ian and I have worked together on a number of different projects. Each one have been very, very different in tone and content. And because we both work for 2K, we wanted to collaborate, take our collaboration to the prog, and therefore wanted to create something and wanted to do something that was different from the other things we do, which is things like New Deadwardians and Wild's End and something. And so something that was sort of very sort of space-based was a departure for us, and something that appealed to us. So I think if we were inspired by anything, I suppose it was the sort of lo-fi tech SF movies of the 70s and 80s. I'm thinking of things like Outland and Alien, even, I suppose. Just that sense of a very real, worn environment in which you could tell a story, and went from there. And sort of as we were working on it, realised there were things like The Expanse you mentioned, which was sort of tonally the same sorts of things. And I, from my point of view, certainly I sort of avoided looking at them until we were well underway so that I wouldn't be unnecessarily influenced by them.
What about you, Ian? What was your what's the thinking behind the visual look of Brink?
Well, a lot of that came from... I'd initially started, did two episodes of it, and I wasn't fully sold on the way that I'd addressed it. And it wasn't until after a spell of not working on it, there was a slight gap because there was some Brass Sun going on at the time. And I came back to it, and then I kind of thought, I was looking at pictures, particularly of subway cars in the 1980s, where they're full of graffiti in New York. And I was looking also at photography of Tokyo at nighttime for color reference, you know, that kind of color palette to it, where neon strip lights come into it. And so, because I was the vibe that I was getting was slightly sort of cyberpunky sort of look to it, but very particularly 80s kind of cyberpunk to it vibe. So very like hot pinks and neon blues and stuff like that. And I was trying to get with how it looks. But also the lived-in quality of the fact that once we're in a place, we just mark it with graffiti anyway. We start writing all over things. And that was a major turning point for me visually on it, because it made it feel a bit more nested and lived in, the world of it. The other reference there was Outland. I think in the way that like those 70s movies... everybody wore pretty much, the clothing was like anything that they could cobble together in a costume room of the relevant period. So they're made up of things like sheriff's uniforms and things like that. Realistic things rather than massively overblown spacesuits and stuff. So I didn't want to go that route. I wanted to keep it relatively... I think the original uniform was like a bomber jacket and things like that. I wanted to keep them quite earth-based, something recognizable to that. That's also long-lasting, like in the way that denim is in terms of clothing.
I got a huge Silent Running vibe in the some of the jumpsuits that are being used as well.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of something about the way that on set they used to just kind of just the background details were just bits that you'd pick up in IKEA or something like that. Quite standard stuff that just has a feeling of functional value to it, not massively aesthetic. So
I think you see that definitely. Silent Running is it certainly will be another thing that was in our minds. Movies of that period, Dark Star, I suppose. Even things like the live action Gerry Anderson things like Space 1999, where there was, for all its 70s style or indeed late 60s style, they had a sort of that sort of cold solid realism of lunar landing footage rather than excessive Star Warsian spaciness. So it was sort of it's sort of grounded SF. It's which is ironic because there's no ground, but it is very much, you know, it's like I said, lo-fi is probably the best thing I can describe in both costumes and everything else, and in the mindset, it is that sort of vision of the future.
We also talked a little bit about people how they would actually set up these bases, and nobody would be really that concerned about the aesthetic of it because they'd be too busy trying to get off the planet to start with. So they'd be all collaborating. You get bits of junk from all over the place. Everything becomes very bog standard. So the sleeping cells that they have, the little bunks, become the familiar patterns when you go from station to station that kind of carry through a little bit because nobody's actually thinking we need to make this distinctly different because they don't care about that. They're just trying to get off planet, off world and be able to be in space. So a lot of the design function behind it was looking at things like from, I guess, 2001 Space Odyssey onwards in terms of design, that big period of time in which, I mean, the closest thing recently, I suppose, is Duncan Jones's Moon, which kind of goes back to that sort of design aesthetic a little bit. But yeah, just trying to get something a bit more a realistic vibe to it.
The thing that really struck me about the environment of Brink is something that I've been thinking a lot about recently with Mega City 1, and funny enough, bleeding into Nemesis, the idea of humans as ants, essentially. You know, what happens when you pack a load of us into a confined space and we begin to behave in very different ways than we do in less dense urban and kind of rural environments. So I very much got that kind of sense of termite about the station.
Yeah, good.
Yeah. I think that underpins the entirety of Brink is the idea that this is it's a kind of temporary solution to an unending problem, that the Earth has died. They've got there's nowhere else to go, so they're living in these cobbled together habitats in space where there is no planet and very limited natural resources and virtually no space. Ironically, I mean, everybody is crowded in the most extraordinary circumstance to the point where, you know, every function of life is determined by that close proximity to other people. Everybody takes the drug we call Nudge, which is the sort of antidepressants, because it's just affecting their entire psychology and behavior to be packed in that way. And also to have no prospect of a future. The idea is that, you know, they're stuck there now. They've got to find a means of living and a means of making it bearable. Because it's never going to go away, they're not going to get their planet back, and that sort of stuff. And therefore, there is no, you know, pot of gold at the rainbow that they're working towards. This is the crap they've ended up in. And of course, that determines the nature of the story. Certainly, in volume one, it's about how is that psychosis affecting individuals and the species as a whole, and is it just a psychological effect, or is there something more to it? And of course, in series two, which is starting this week, we play with that idea because a lot of the action is set on a new habitat that's under construction, and there is that there are very few people aboard it. So it's unnaturally empty compared to all the other environments that any of them have ever been in. And there are several moments where the characters reflect on the idea that this unnecessary, what seems excessive space around them, big rooms and chambers and corridors with nobody in it, is actually almost terrifying because they've become unused to that situation.
Mm. Let's go back to Brass Tacks. For those people who listening to this podcast and don't necessarily, maybe didn't read the first series or just need a refresher.
They're fools, Michael. Fools.
give us a quick praise of what Brink is about, what point we're at now.
Me? Yeah. Well, Brink refers to two things. It refers to one of the main characters as we join it in the first series is called Brinkman, and everybody calls him Brink. But Brink is also a reference to the Brink, which is the slang term for this huge arrangement of habitats and orbitals and satellites and space stations, which mankind has had to evacuate to because the Earth has died. This is a couple of hundred years in the future. The Earth has just simply collapsed and died, and humanity has had to sort of export itself out into essentially a shanty town in space, where it is now living the best life it can live without any prospect of knowing what that's going to be about. So it's claustrophobic, it's unpleasant, but routines and life have got to go on. There is still industry, there are still people raising families, there's still, you know, everything that was going on Earth has sort of had to be at least translated into some kind of orbital version of that existence. And the story focuses on essentially policemen. It's a police procedure. It's about two detectives who from the Habitat Security Division who are trying to just look after people and police crimes as they occur in this unnaturally claustrophobic environment. And the two of them, Brink and Curtis, stumble across a murder which suggests that actually there might be something much more insidious going on, as I mentioned just now, that the idea that the psychological damage to the human race because of what's happened to it is so intense that it is causing almost sort of phantasmagorical beliefs to arise. And so the story is fairly linear because it's about them investigating this crime and who did it and why. But it also begins to become more uncanny than that because they feel they're sort of picking at a scab and that actually perhaps some of these delusions and these madnesses have some reality to them. So there is an increasing sense of something disturbing just in the corner of your eye as it goes through. And I think the sort of claustrophobic environment in Ian's artwork certainly creates that sort of tight, contained environment, and we deliberately, organically, it wasn't a choice really, but once we've got it, we went with it. With the actual storytelling of the entire thing, and this is true of book two as well, it is very different from the way we would normally approach it because it's entirely dialogue. It's all character driven. It's about people having conversations as they slowly pick this mystery apart. So by comparison to other 2000 AD strips, I suppose it could be accused of being slow moving. It is a very sort of talky, conversational thing, and there is no narrative at all. We dropped people in right from page one without any exposition about what the world was, but we also, because we were only using dialogue, didn't want to have people saying, well, as you know, Brink, we've been on this habitat for, you know, we didn't want any of those sort of Basil exposition moments of explaining things as we went along. So we employed a technique which we call tags, ironically, because we use so much graffiti, but little sort of, they're almost like footnotes that appear within the strip, identifying objects and places and things for the benefit of the reader, as if it's being given to you by some sort of Google Earth system that is supplying information. So that we just didn't bother to explain anything as we started. We just went straight into it, and that means the dialogue is much more naturalistic and much more real, I guess, real sounding, because it doesn't have to allow for that explaining as we go along thing. And once we got that, we felt that the storytelling tone really, really nicely matched the sort of claustrophobia of the story we were actually telling.
Well, Ian, just coming off what Dan's just said, in terms of dialogue and narration, etc., you know, avoiding unnecessary exposition is key. in terms of visual language, how do you set up a world without big arrows pointing at everything? Well, obviously the strip has little arrows pointing at things, but
it does have smaller arrows. Yeah.
but without kind of going, you know, look at all these vistas, which, you know, we'll never pay this much attention to again. Is there a similar kind of way to kind of downplay the visual language so you're getting the information but not in a kind of stagey way?
Oh gosh, what a question. I'll get there. I'll think about it. I've always liked stories which just drop you slap bang in the middle of stuff anyway. Mm. Empire Strikes Back's always the best one because I quite like the fact that I would take that movie on the basis that there was nothing before it or after it. Because I like the idea of just jumping into the middle of something, being able to pick up something, not know where the hell you are, and just go straight into the story. And I think the tags system that we do have actually helps you with that quite considerably. I think within the world of it, I kind of like the idea. I think what helped it in the very beginning of it was that sense of the graffiti, the lived-in quality to it, so that you feel like you just take it for granted what's there in the background. So there's people hanging the washing over something that should be architecturally lovely to look at, or, you know, anything like that, I think helps to kind of establish the lived-in feel, the quality that it's something that you just stumbled upon, you kind of opened a door and there it was. And I think within an... The thing with this is, like, for example, to contrast to Brass Sun, the difference in working on this, Brass Sun is something which is just made up on the fly completely. I'll get a script and just that week you'll get the very first design I actually thought popped into my head. But this is a very different story because with this I have to lock it down in terms of how it looks. And that thing that I was saying earlier about there being a consistency between the sites because they kind of got up into space. So like a bunk looks like a bunk. So there's elements that are always going to kind of repeat and have a pattern to them. So I guess the design functionality of it has to break down to several recognizable elements within a scene. So there'll be like a running strip in the walls that glows, or there'll be like a bunk looks a certain way. There has to be kind of like a consistent language going on all the time. And it can be small, but like having that like pop up every now and then within a scene just to kind of remind you that this is Brink, you're in the world of Brink now, that sort of thing. I think those things sort of hold the whole thing together, like termites holding hands. Mm-hmm. Expression for a house falling apart. But I think, does that answer the question? Have I got completely off the...
That's good. What I wanted to ask you is something about the colours and also how that feeds into the storytelling that you both do together, in that we, just to hark back to some of the 70s stuff that we were talking about earlier, yeah, a lot of the thing they didn't have to rely on back then because cinematography wasn't where it is now is colour. Yes. So where you had guys in jumpsuits, they were very much in their jumpsuits and it kind of all looked a bit shaky. But here you've got, like you say, the neons and the blues to really add to the intensity and the plot boiler elements of what's going on. I kind of wanted to just ask, because there's so much clearly built into this world that you guys have to work out way ahead of time because it's so integral, the design elements, how does that relationship between the two of you work in terms of how you work it out ahead? And also how it's changed from where you originally started working together. That's quite a large one. But
I think generally in the way that we work, in the way that works, especially for something like 2000 AD, we're doing it five pages at a time. And Dan writes it. He writes it five pages. I draw it. He writes the next bit. I draw it. It kind of works backwards and forwards like that. Mm. But I think that what really helps is that in the way that we work on this, we riff more, I guess. Because there's elements of things like, for example, right back to part one, the original room, the way that crime scene was described was that the guy was lying on the floor. And I remember thinking, I think it was something like, it had to do with like, I think it was the film Gravity or it was, but it's also Star Trek, the one where they shoot the Klingons and the purple blood in zero grav. You know, I was thinking about the fact that the way fluid actually reacts in zero gravity and the very fact that we're in space meant that scene's floating. And then just after calling Dan and saying, well, I've got this idea of having this floating body rather than actually locked down. Then we had a long discussion about, for example, how they actually deal with crime scenes in space and how they lock down a crime scene. Because one of the first things investigators do when they show up on a crime scene is they mark down where everything is. But if it's floating, how do you do that? So we had that essentially there's a rule that where it falls is where it falls, right? So when they switch the gravity off, everything drops down. But because we start talking about this idea of having ambigrav in it, and then that became part of it, that then affects something that happens later on in the story. So in a way, that's really all that comes from is really riffing in a way. Like two musicians jamming, basically. It's just you come up with a bass line or the drummer comes in with the beat. It doesn't, you know, you kind of come in with different stuff creatively. It kind of then contributes to the whole world. I mean, we had a long discussion after that, didn't we, Dan, about the way that we were talking about rationing out gravity in a way, or maybe they kind of power down the room so you haven't got an option. You just have to float, you know. So, no. And a lot of these people that sleep in zero G as well, you know, so you get
that's certainly a very good example, because as far as I was concerned, I was just picturing a space station where people could walk around and the nature of gravity and where it came from was not up for discussion. It was just one of those things you took on faith in the same way you do in Star Trek or whatever. And when Ian said, I'd love to see the crime scene floating, we went, okay, well, in that case, gravity gets switched on and off. It's clearly a system that works like that. So we realized that it had to be, a system rather than as a physical product of the environment. Once we had that, and in order to establish that, we needed to know for our own sakes how that worked, so that Ian could draw the scene that way. And we need to rationalize it, even if we didn't go into great detail. And once we got done that sort of groundwork, as Ian says, later on there was a scene where I went, oh, this is brilliant. We can use that for a very, very strong visual and dramatic sequence where it will really matter. And I think that's it. There's quite a lot of things that get invented and then they don't necessarily get exploited immediately, or they weren't needed necessarily for the overall story, but they were needed for ourselves to explain how something would be the way it is. And once you've got that idea, you go, wait a minute, I can see a use for that. I remember very early on, Ian always sends me sketches and pages as he's working to show his process. You know, designs a spaceship, sends me, is that the sort of spaceship you had in mind? And we can have a chat about it. But he sent me this amazing sort of CAD display diagram of the space station to see if that's the sort of thing I had in mind. And it was amazing. And it was sort of a proper engineering document. And I went, that's brilliant. And then I said to him, which page is this? Which page are you using it on? He went, no, it's I'm not using it. It's just so that I know what the design looks like. And I went,
it's so that basically we kind of know what we're talking about vaguely, like, because it's very difficult. That's like to get, I suppose there's like there's a no man's land between the writer and the artist in terms of figuring out things like staging or like, where characters are actually in relation to something in space. Because there's one thing for a writer to write it or even the artist to draw it, but then communicating between the two of you, I think, is pretty important to be able to do. And all that consists of is a phone call and a very long conversation about weird stuff. And then that goes completely off where you were going from. But yeah, no, it's kind of, but I loved it when then he kind of used that as an actual, quite an important plot point later on. And I thought, that, I suppose, in musical terms, is the bit where the bassist looks at the drummer and smiles.
It is. And even with that engineering design, when you show me the engineering design, I said, you've got to use that. It's so good. Don't let it be background notes. Let's use it somewhere. So we made sure that those sort of schematics that Ian was producing, just for his own design sensibility, so he knew how things worked and I could see what he was imagining, we then used them as graphics. We said, let's actually see these, because these are things that would appear in universe. So that those working out our problems in advance gave us answers that we then shared and used in the story.
There's one thing that I kind of wanted to touch on, coming back to the psychology of this kind of environment. It's really reminding me of your classic sci-fi, like Clark's Rendezvous with Rama, and also your more modern sci-fi with Ian M. Banks. This kind of the pressure on the human psyche of being in an environment that is alien. Where there is no relief. And talking about The Expanse, that's something that actually I really enjoyed about that show, was that there was always that sense of people wanting fresh air, of wanting open spaces, but never being able to get them. So there's constant claustrophobia. So I'm curious about how you seed in things like, because you know people can go, oh, I feel so under pressure, I would love an open space, and you know you talk about the new habitat that has lots of open space, but I'm curious about whether the kind of beats, the explanatory beats, kind of come naturally, or whether they you put them in purposefully, you know, that really kind of bring the atmosphere to life, both visually and in terms of writing.
Well, I certainly I didn't want anybody at any point to turn around and go, gosh, I feel so cooped up in this tin can. I didn't want that kind of thing. What I wanted it to do is I wanted it to show, for example, that Brink himself as a character was felt, without even really knowing it himself or without being able to vocalize it, was under huge pressure and was probably much more stressed by his environment and had problems with the environment. So there are moments where the characters interact with other characters and things come out in conversation. For instance, Brink and Curtis might have a conversation about why someone's gone crazy, and they will talk about the pressures on that person because it's part of the case. But from that, we realize by extension that must be the case for everybody in this environment, including them. And when they meet in series one, when they meet a character on the transit on the way to the other station, and she's a health food nut, and she talks about how so many of their problems can be solved, you know, physical problems. And she sort of lists all the things that are wrong with Brink, the fact that he's overweight and he's got high blood pressure and he's got psoriasis and all sort of that. And she's saying, just eat better and eat more healthily, and you can do this and get off those horrible antidepressants. And again, it's world building. It's part of the story because that character is significant. But it also tells us a lot about the other characters, their psychological states, and therefore, by extension, everybody else in the world. And as I say, in series two, there is a moment where a character is just so almost scared of the fact that the room is huge and empty. And so actually the pressure working the other way around, they've become so used to never being alone and never being in a room bigger than a shoebox. And suddenly they're not, that is almost more depressing. The thing they've been dreaming about up to that point, wouldn't it be nice to have space and sky and air and fresh air and that kind of stuff, they sort of get given it, and it feels horrible. It's like they have an allergic reaction to it. Mm.
Yeah, we have these large, large spaces in it, and it was kind of like, and in some ways, some of those spaces aren't—they're a bit bigger, but they're not. Sometimes they're not that much bigger than certain parts of the other station that were in part one. The only massive difference in those spaces is that there's absolutely thousands of people crushed into those spaces, whereas actually, when you're in this other place where there are no people, that space becomes very apparent. So there's a lot of being able to play around with that. And I guess as writers and artists, you're very aware of what cabin fever's like. You know, there's no end of there's a pool of resources to draw on from there. Cause the space I work in is 6x8, which is technically a prison cell. So knowing what that's actually like and better convey that into the work is not a problem.
Yeah, and my office is actually set up in a Jefferies tube, so I'm lying prone with virtually no head clearance whatsoever.
Well, you know, we like to make sure that you don't run off. That's the important thing.
Although I did think the manacle was a little unnecessary.
Well, one thing that has really struck me about this conversation is, number one, I mean, you mentioned the origin of the title of the strip, which is Brink, but to my mind, that brings up the sense of on the brink, you know, on the brink of extinction kind of thing. You know, this is mankind's last gasp. And how do you stop a strip like that descending into nihilism or just, you know, how do you have characters that are very busy ignoring the massive elephant? It's not just an elephant in the room and it's an entire herd. This, you know, there is no, as you've said, good end to this.
We haven't read the end yet.
Yeah, that's true.
In some respects, I don't think there is. I don't think we do stop it plunging into nihilism because that's the point. The point is that this life that they're existing in has become business as usual, and everybody's going about their daily business, going, "Well, this is what life is like now." Trying not to think about the fact that it's A, terrible, and B, it's never going to change, or if it does change, it's only going to be changed in a very negative way. It's going to become worse. So there is, although it's not a technically a main thrust of the plot of book one, there is a lot of discussion about what else they can do. And in fact, some of the characters have a strong belief in other possible, as it were, escapes or alternatives to this existence. And so there is, people find hope in all sorts of different places. And you either find the perseverance to carry on with your life in those circumstances by simply ignoring it and getting on with your job because you consider your job to be important, like, for instance, Brink himself does that, or some of the others are sort of reacting more rebelliously to that and going, no, there is a much more radical answer to this problem. So that sort of thin string of hope exists in there in some of the sort of subplot discussions. But I say... It is. I think it is a gloomy, depressing environment, and I think even the light-hearted conversations they sometimes have and the wisecracking is just sort of whistling in the face of doom. It's just they know that this is not something that can persevere. They can't. They can keep going, but will the actual society itself keep going? And I think that adds to the tension because there is this uncanny thing creeping up on them all the time that could simply be the mass psychosis of the race about to collapse just because of that environment. I think that is all part of the tone. I think that's part of the sort of space noirish tone of it, that it's a, you know, nothing is really particularly happy or good, yet they manage to wander through it being reasonably smart ass about it because it is that sort of flippancy in the face of something terrible.
There is also that element that's always very strong in crime fiction of pressure, that there's either a pressure of time or a pressure of the authorities or conspiracy or whatever, and it's something. I mean, we've already mentioned Outland, which is my favourite Sean Connery film ever.
But not Zardoz.
Not Zardoz.
Oh, my God.
If
come on.
If you're going to say things like that,
sorry,
I'm not going to invite
you
back on.
I'm not back, am I?
So I'm getting stared at by Nick through the window as well. I'm clearly in a minority here. Things like Outland, but also there was a novel called The Last Policeman, which is about a guy trying to solve a murder before an asteroid hits the Earth. So he's literally under time pressure. So I guess that you've created that pressure ultimately, haven't you? Both physically in terms of the environment and figuratively in terms of the time pressure that's ticking away, the end of humanity. Mm.
Yeah, and also, I mean, there is the actual natural pressure of a police case. They've got to bring it home. They've got to solve the crime. They've got to stop the crime happening again. They've got to do all those sorts of things. And that's layered in book one with not so much a conspiracy, but certainly the sense that the superiors don't really like the way they're doing it, and you know, they can't afford to do it for much longer and that kind of stuff. But yes, the unlike the ticking clock you get in most murder mysteries, the real pressure is the environment, because in some respects the environment is also the suspect. You know, we've got to catch the suspect before it's too late. Well, it's too late because the environment is the suspect, and the suspect is what's doing this to people. Mm. And I think that is part of it. So it transposes all those tropes of pressure and time sensitivity of a classic murder mystery into science fiction, rather than just transplanting it into a spaceship and going, okay, we're going to tell the story here, and it's just simply Agatha Christie with airlocks. It becomes much more, you know, the science fiction element.
I'm writing that one down.
That's going on the cover.
Yeah.
Oh, damn it, that's my next pitch for 2018.
Ian, one thing that really struck me, particularly about the opening of the new series, is an issue of class. Because, of course, when you get any human society, invariably it becomes not only hierarchical but class-bound. Yeah. How How have you been able to show the strata of this society visually?
I think it's the very first shot we have is like the illusion that they're on some sort of tropical location, and it's and it pulls away, and then you know this sort of falseness to it. It's funny. I was traveling by. This is going to sound like I'm going completely off track and I've lost my mind. I was traveling by first class once. Somebody had bought me a first class ticket because I wouldn't buy one. But I was traveling by first class on several different trains across the country. Sounds posh, doesn't it? And I noticed at a certain point, I think it was Great Western when I got on that one, and all the seats inside this place were peeling because they were like, there was a train that was a first class maybe in the 80s. And it was just falling apart. But these people were still paying for a first class ticket for this train and the luxuries of being first class, where it was awful. I was kind of thinking of it in those terms visually. There'd be like, I liked the bit where just kind of it reveals that it's just a room and not this tropical beach. I think the kind of there's a certain allusion to that sort of quality of life, I think, that people buy into. And, you know, so I think it's a sustaining of that illusion for those characters to be able to have that. Do you get what I mean? It's kind of like they're all essentially in the same boat, but they're just trying to make their boat nicer. But they're still stuck in the same predicament. There's still a massive psychological denial going on there to the actual situation. I think that's reflective of the world that we live in now as well, because essentially we've got these big companies pumping out oil, and they know they shouldn't be doing that. They should be plowing their finances into something else, alternative means. But I think it's very it's easily reflectable. Reflectable? Is that the word? Yeah, we'll go with
it. We'll make it with a word. There we go. Yeah. Hey, from a comic book that invented words like Zarjaz and Skrotnik.
You can't lecture me.
Yeah, there are no rules.
Made up words. It does have that vibe to it, I think, when you're kind of illustrating the characters to be that way. You know, yeah, it's really difficult to say it without being kind of too current, but if you've got a guy that lives in a gold tower with a gold elevator and it's got gold everywhere, and it's just this idea that that must mean wealth, and therefore I've got to paint it all over the place. It's very easy to show culture class in that way, that difference of class. So they have that sort of sense of an open space, and you know, as Dan was saying earlier about characters that have not been in that, they've been in an environment which is essentially a tin can, very closed and claustrophobic environment, to go into somewhere like that and feel funny about it.
I guess mentioning no names but talking about gold towers and things like that, when you have an environment where something is scarce, that thing automatically becomes valuable. So the use and display of that thing
exactly
is intended to show wealth.
No, absolutely. It's the ostentatious use of space to have a cabin or a suite or whatever that is bigger than 8 or 9 regular homes for less privileged people is part of it. And that certainly was a distinct choice we made in book two, is that book one is very much about the sort of common life, and loads of references are made to the big corporations, the people who run it, the people in power, and the fact that everything is geared up to making those corporations more money, even despite the ridiculous situation they're in. And in book two, we're going to see more of that. We're going to enter that world. And as Ian says, they're in an equal state of denial. They're just being slightly more comfortable about it whilst the ship sinks. And that is part of opening up, I suppose, not a greater conspiracy, but a greater subplot to the whole world, is that we realize that the people in power are as mystified by everything as everything else, and indeed their power is ephemeral and sort of worthless. That's really why we took the story in the direction that we did.
There's another point to it, is that you've got like a brand new station there as well, and so there's not been loads of people living there. So the element, that signature thing of part one, which was like graffiti everywhere, I don't have that. So one of the things I went back and looked at was, well, what way could I actually display this? You know, the, something to keep it busy, you know, some sort of element of the environment that keeps it busy. And one of the things I put in is this idea of having holograms, because the idea of that wealth and stuff is this illusory sort of depiction. And I sort of quote, you know, so we then move on to having holographic plants and things like that. They're not real. It's just some projection, or there's a light display, or there's something to keep your eyes busy, especially for the people there, you know, some sort of eye candy for them. But it's not, it's fake, you know. So I guess in a way it kind of answers that question that you probably
there's a huge discussion to be had about the illusory nature of human experience and society, but we won't get into that for the time being. But I've just got one last question, which is harking back to our to the beginning of our discussion. Is we immediately started name checking movies of the 70s and 80s that we enjoy, the aesthetic of them, the feel of them, the way that they portrayed the future. And I find it interesting that considering that 2000 AD came out of that age, you know, it was originally if you look at Kevin Gosnell's memo at IPC, it was about capitalizing on this new wave of sci-fi films that were coming up, even though they didn't necessarily know how popular they were going to be. But we're still drawing influence. We're still drawing art from this period, from the late 70s and 80s sci-fi. Why do you guys think that is still so influential in how science fiction and comic books and everything is done now?
Did you see the images I think NASA brought out, and it was for the new spacesuit, where it essentially looks like the spacesuits from Hergé's Destination Moon?
Oh no, I didn't.
Did you not see that?
No.
It was like a bubbly costume. And it was like one moment when I was looking at that and I was thinking there was like a real sort of 1940s, 50s aesthetic going on in terms of what the projection of what sci-fi would be like came from. I said that all in one breath and ran out at the end. But there are moments, I think, where we kind of... The 70s for us is almost like the antique futurism of like the previous generation, where they kind of looked at the 1940s and the 50s. And I think in a way there's a wealth of stuff there because it's recognizable. We have this thing of falling also into this nostalgia trap and not really thinking more towards the future, I guess. Because we don't want to, and in a way, when you've got a world that's, you know, for something like Brink, that's kind of ideal in a way, because of the fact that they're not really, that whole thing of denying that future in a way is what they're doing. So they kind of jump back to things they're familiar with, and I think a lot of that because in the 70s, that kind of sci-fi, like I was saying, it's like they just go off and buy something, you know, that was functional but fairly bland looking, I'm thinking of Star Wars with those cups that they have that blue milk in, or whatever the hell that is.
That wonderful kind of
the Tupperware.
Basically.
Tupperware. Yeah, it was just like bought from some sort of Lakeland Plastics or something during the time, or you know, all those sorts of things. It's the tip. It's like the junkyard of the latter part of that century, in terms of what goes into those movies. And I think that they're all almost like comfort foods visually. And I think maybe that's what it is. It's some sort of like recognizable element, because then the minute you get those NASA spacesuits, they kind of look ridiculous and not real. And I suppose, I don't know. I get to a point in sentences where I get probably just to the end of one sentence where I think, what was the question?
I do think there are several other influences there. I mean, Ian and I are people of a certain age, and therefore those, you know, we are embedded in the nostalgia that we have for the stuff that influenced our imagination when we were young and susceptible.
Yeah.
So it is inevitably the movies of the 70s and 80s, and it is early 2000 AD as well, so that we are... It sort of no matter how hard we try, we're inevitably going to hark back on those, because those are the things we look at and go, oh, that's what science fiction is. That's what space is. That's how exciting that sort of thing is. Even though, you know, we all watch new stuff, we all read new stuff, and it's wonderful, and it's incredible, and we try and stay aware. I'm very, very conscious of trying not to feel like I'm stagnating in some sort of 80s retro throwback sense of imagination. I always want to try and push forward and find new things to visualize and everything like that. However, having said that, despite the sort of actual trappings of our own nostalgia, which I think is influential, there is a strong case to be made for the actually sort of, there is a period of time from, I guess, around about the late 60s, 2001 Space Odyssey onwards through to, I guess, the late 80s, early 90s, that was a sort of golden age of science fiction in cinema. And there are amazing films being made today and have been made in the last few years, extraordinary things which have presented vistas of the imagination that are quite extraordinary, thanks to the advances in special effects done through computer animation, which are amazing. But what they seem to deliver to me is a sense of extraordinary wonder and thrill and all those sort of very positive things, which is why possibly we have a boom in superhero movies, and we have, you know, sort of so many extraordinarily, almost extravagant movies where literally anything is possible. But in that period from late 60s through to late 80s, before the advent of full-on computer animation, all special effects were done practically. They were through model work and through camera work and through matte paintings and through that. So it was the golden age of the physical special effect. Things like Alien, Blade Runner, The Thing, Terminator. All of those films relied absolutely on the craft of the special effects creator, the actual sort of engineer who would make these things and make them work. And I think the one thing that they had, which is perhaps lacking, or certainly was lacking for a long time in post-computer generation movies, is an extraordinary sense of the real. Because you looked at something, and no matter how crappy the alien or the robot or whatever it was actually there. Mm. And there is a nuance to the way people react to that. An actor reacts to something he's literally seeing in front of him. It is such a tiny, subtle thing that it's almost impossible to correct it, but there is a different, an actor responding to a model of the predator appearing in front of him, his actual eye response and dilation is going to be different to the way he would respond if he was in a green screen reacting to something that was being held up on a stick, because that's what he's being told to look at. And I think therefore those films that we are referring to have an air of credibility that is perhaps been lacking since, even if the special effects and the visualization of the future is often looks dated and poor and slightly shoddy by comparison to the things that can be achieved now. And I often look back at those because I genuinely believe those things are happening. I look at The Thing as a good example, or Terminator, and I genuinely believe those things are happening, even though nowadays those things would be much more, in inverted commas, realistic and extraordinary to look at if they were done through modern special effects. And I think that's possibly why so many people in the industry look back at that period of movies and draw inspiration from them.
Okay, it's notable that with many of the new Star Wars films and things like that, the filmmakers are at pains to point out how much real stuff they're making.
Exactly, yeah.
They're trying to bring it back to a more tactile experience with all these movies. But I'd argue as well, one of the important central things that was hanging on The Thing and Terminator and all those old movies was that the core central ideas and themes and concepts of those movies was the strongest and reflected those time periods really well. Mm. You know, eco issues and paranoia, especially with The Thing. And there's always a core central theme that's really being utilized the best.
That's an interesting point. Are the best times for science fiction when there is social disruption, a sense of fear, a sense of you know, people feeling a disconnect from what's going on? Because, you know, maybe it's not a coincidence that we are in a new golden age of science fiction again.
Yes, I think there's probably a very, very strong case to be made for that. I think that's true in other sort of arts. I, I, I've had several conversations. I've just coincidentally had several conversations over the last year or so with comedians, stand-up comedians, who hark back to the golden age of the 80s, where they had something to shout about and to be political about. And the fact that that they sort of are beginning to have that again. And that seems a vibrant, exciting thing to do. That actually when, but I also wonder whether we're capable really of recognizing these things now. I wonder how many films that have been made, say, in the last 5 years, that in 10 years or 20 years' time will be regarded as absolute classics of science fiction, because from that perspective, we're going, oh, gosh, that was really a product of its times. Mm-hmm. And you can see the political ideas that were driving that story forward. But actually, because we're so close to it right now, we're having much greater difficulty looking at it, whereas a film like The Thing, to cite that example again, or The Terminator, which was great and exciting and brilliant and innovative at the time, but nowadays we look back on it and go, oh, and it was also a movie of the 80s, and it came out of all those feelings. So I think we're possibly erring on the side of denigrating current movie making simply because it's all of these things are primarily entertainment. They're films put out, or books put out, or whatever, to entertain us right now. And actually, as you move past them, may get that degree of an aura about them where you begin to regard them as a cultural artifact, which is not only entertaining of itself, but is redolent of its time and place, and actually conveys a greater message than it might have done to the people who sat down and watched it at the time.
No, absolutely, and all these things are latent at the end of the day. You know, when in any creative act, I guess, you are funneling all the things that you're feeling and thinking about, even if you don't realise it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, now that is absolutely the case in all sorts of very, very strange ways. Actually, things will... it's been pointed out to me on a number of occasions where things that I've done in comics or indeed books, a reader has come up to me at a signing, for instance, and said, oh, was that... Were you talking about that then? And I go, no, and then realise I must have been. But I wasn't aware of it. You're not aware of how you're channeling your immediate environment, your day-to-day life, your, you know, anything like that, what's going on in the world around you, into something. I think actually some of the times where people have been specific about doing that, have gone, I'm going out of my way now to write an allegory of Trump in this whatever, and it's like, well, that feels very leaden and wrong-footed, because you're doing it deliberately. But if you were just writing a story that people then went, oh my gosh, that's an allegory of Trump, and it actually is much more effective as a result of that, I think that's subliminal immersion in one's environment and how one that then delivers it in forms of a story is the most successful and the most inevitable way that any creator is going to work.
Brilliant. I think also that these things come around and go around, and they kind of happen in loops. And you get something, the zeitgeist, I suppose, kind of resets itself every 30 years or 15 years and kind of comes around and goes around, and it's essentially the same thing over and over again, just with different hats, I think. So I think that just the way that history, I think, works, it doesn't really work in a linear fashion where you just get a beginning and a middle and an end. It's a cyclical fashion where it kind of comes around and comes around again. And we kind of know it, because you get a lot of people that sort of say, oh, that almost predicted this would happen. And it's kind of, well, it's more the case that we kind of maybe make the same mistakes over and over again.
And I think there is also a danger of looking back at films of, say, 20 or 30 years ago, or TV shows, and going, gosh, almost condescendingly going, gosh, weren't they clever to think of that?
Yes.
In their small back.
That was never even conceivable. And then you go and sit down and you read Plato and you kind of go, wow, wasn't he clever?
Yeah. There is that condescension of the assumption that they have absolutely, A, no imagination, or B, no grasp of what was going on in the world, or B, someone lived in some kind of primitive world where these things didn't exist. And we go, oh, of course, we know much better today. But I recently rewatched all the episodes of the I think it's 1969 British TV show Doomwatch, which is superb program. It's a shame that all the episodes have not survived, but that's all about environmental issues, and it's all very real world. And I found myself watching the first few episodes going, oh my god, how could they have been so predictive? How did they know that they were writing stories about things that hadn't yet happened, and therefore they seem incredibly prophetic, except that just because they hadn't yet happened, it wasn't that nobody had realised they were going to, and that they hadn't already worried about what overcrowding would do, or how plastics would ruin the world, or what lead in petrol was, all of those things. And it's like, well, they've just made the imaginative leap that every single science fiction writer ever has always made, which is to project where something is likely to go if it happens, and then write about it. And I sort of metaphorically slap myself after about three episodes of Doomwatch going, why are you being so condescending to the creators of the show? Of course they're getting it right. Just because it hasn't happened yet didn't mean to say they were going, oh, but this brilliant idea. It was just going on.
Well, coming from a writer who envisaged the end of humanity being us all shut in a tin can in space with a dead Earth, that's really very worrying.
You also sat at the end of that watching Doomwatch and go, why has nobody done anything about this? But also, you can do that right the way. So you can take something that we made a mistake, I don't know. You could literally take the Battle of Troy and place it 100 years from now. It probably will happen again. It's that sort of, you could take any part of it. I think that's the nature of humanity, I suppose, is to make those mistakes over and over again in that way. But I think
somebody once said, history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes.
Well, many thanks to Dan and to Ian for joining us. It was an absolute pleasure to really dig down into Brink, and the new series is off to a great start. So if you are not reading 2000 AD, then make sure you're picking up this issue, ideal for new and lapsed readers. Owen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our absolute pleasure. My pleasure. Yeah, my podcast.
Just you.
Yeah.
No one else is pleased.
Get out! it's been fantastic. And join us in 2 weeks, Earthlets, where we're going to be talking more about what's in the galaxy's greatest comic at the moment. And we've got some great big interviews coming up over the next few months. So make sure that you subscribe to us, whether it's on iTunes, Podomatic or SoundCloud. Next week we're going to be running another panel from the 40th anniversary show, so make sure you tune in for that if you haven't listened to it already. Go along to youtube.com/2000AD online. Now all of the panels for the 40th anniversary show are up there. We've added the last couple, which is Pat Mills' retrospective and the Editors Reunited, which is an absolutely fascinating panel. You've got one current editor, three ex-editors, and one ex-editor in the audience as well. So it's a unique opportunity to hear all these guys speak about editing the galaxy's greatest. In the meantime, from myself and from Owen, Splendid Verthrig.
Alert! 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 Full power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline and follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.